Coming up on Tech Nation, a special edition of Tech Nation Health. We'll hear from the doctor who researched the effects of low-level lead poisoning in children in the poorest socioeconomic areas and decided to do something about it. That would be Dr. Herb Needleman, who passed away recently. Then Dr. Perry Neeson, CEO of Sanford Berman Prebys Medical Discovery Institute, pioneering a new way to discover drugs. And Dr. Oliver Fetzer, CEO of Synthetic Genomics. Type in a few letters on your computer and DNA is produced right in your lab overnight. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Last time I checked, our perception of media reality was somewhere between Andy Warhol's "In the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes," and the idea that modern news lived and then instantly disappeared on the 24-hour news cycle. And it was pretty much common knowledge how to work the system. Schedule a press conference or issue a press release just in time to be scooped up by all the evening news shows. And if you wanted to bury your news but couldn't avoid announcing it, you did the same thing, only sometime after 5 p.m. on Friday, crossing your fingers that your news would slip by with a minimum of notice. But things have changed. Now, instead of the early evening news and the late evening news, we get 24-hour news, as it's happening. And with nary the blink of an eye, it pivots. The 24-hour news cycle has a slightly different character over the weekend, chewing on Friday news. But barring any stupendously newsworthy event, it just needs to keep the machine going until Monday, and primetime news can begin again. Even so, all the bets are off. On any day of the week, President Donald J. Trump generally gets up sometime pre-dawn, and we're talking East Coast time here. He tweets a little or a lot, benign or shocking, and all the East Coast media swoop into action, from newspapers or their online counterparts to television and radio. Journalists are all reading the tweets, checking the facts against all their data, and doing background. The pundits are revving up their opinions, readying point, counterpoint, and the cameras are rolling. This fuels the entire morning before normal press events can even begin. And what's going on the West Coast? In that time zone 3 hours earlier? Why, we're sleeping in. By the time we wake up, the tweet storm has formed and let out anything from a light drizzle to thunderbolts and lightning. The tweets and their targets have been analyzed down to each of their 140 characters, and responses come in one after another. Sometimes the news is that there isn't a tweet storm, as when the president traveled to Europe. But note, all this is happening in addition to the normal morning news cycle. I've been asked repeatedly if I think this reflects the future of media, and I come down on the side of no. This reflects the, shall we say, uncommon personality of one person who has a penchant for dashing off tweets off the top of his head and suddenly making an off-script public announcement, many fueled by his emotional state or the information he just viewed on television. And before you know it, there's another media firestorm. We can look at technology all day and all night and know this isn't about technology. This is about one person. Frankly, the media is exhausted. And even as we can see the vulnerability of the social and media communication structure and the technology which drives it, we know this isn't forever. And then we can look back and study it. Maybe it will be called the Confefe syndrome. So stunned were we at the unrecognizable word which made it past the autospeller. Like it or not, waiting for it to end, there's no denying it. In the meantime, the media is forced to hang on every word. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, a special edition of Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. First up, we'll look back and see that today, science and its scientists face the same challenges as it did 50 years ago. We'll hear from Dr. Herb Needleman, who measured the impact of very low levels of lead in children, and the result removed lead from household paint and put unleaded gasoline in our cars. Then I'll speak with another scientist who wanted research to reach the people who needed it, Dr. Perry Neeson, the CEO of Sanford Burnham Prebys Medical Discovery Institute, and Dr. Oliver Fetzer, the CEO of Synthetic Genomics, enabling scientists to specify and create unique DNA overnight in their labs. Pediatrician, child psychiatrist, and researcher Dr. Herb Needleman is best known for his research studies concerning neurodevelopmental damages caused by lead poisoning. At the time of this 2008 interview, he was a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. I asked him when he first learned about lead poisoning in children.
Well, during my training, in my residency in pediatrics, I was referred a child who was a very sick little girl who had lead poisoning. Somebody else made the diagnosis. And I knew what to do because I'd had a couple lectures on it. So I started an IV and started running in EDTA, which was the drug we used in those days. And I watched her slowly wake up over the next couple of days and then begin to cry and then begin to smile. And I told the mother, you're going to be able to take your baby home in the next couple of days, but you got to move out of that house because if she's re-exposed, she's going to be doomed. And the mother, who had been very grateful to me, said, she looked at me angrily to say, where am I going to move? Any house that I can afford in my neighborhood is no different than the house I live in. And that woke me up that this problem was not just a matter of making a diagnosis and giving a pill. It was in the life situation of inner city people. And I became fascinated with it, and that's what started my career in that. And I kind of turned away from other things that I didn't think were as important.
Now, about when was that?
1955, I think. Yeah, I was a resident in pediatrics. I'd gotten out of the Army Medical Corps and went back to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia to complete my residency in pediatrics.
Where was lead in the American environment in the mid-1950s?
It was all over.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Almost all the houses were painted with white lead. White lead is sticky, it's bright, and the only trouble is it's poisonous. And the paint companies promoted it extraordinarily, and they promoted it for children. They had little coloring books for children, etc. So there was a lot of pressure to use lead paint. Then that continued until the 70s when a law banning its use in household paint was passed in Congress.
Did you know at the time that it was the lead paint?
The commonest source for children was lead paint. It chips and peels, and it's got as much as 50% lead in a flake of paint, so you don't need very much to be poisoned.
And how does it enter the body?
They eat it. It's sweet.
It's sweet.
It's sweet and crunchy, and lots of kids eat it to their, deficit.
Now, that patient recovered, as far as you know. Does that mean that she would have been completely cured?
The conventional wisdom was, let me take you back a little bit. There was no recognition that children were lead poisoned until the later part of the 19th century. In 1892, a physician in Brisbane, Australia, reported the first case of childhood lead poisoning. Before that, it was thought to be a disease of industry, that painters and metal workers got poisoned. And Lockhart Gibson proved that it was also affected children. And then it was thought that if you recovered from it, you were left without a trace of the illness. People said if the child doesn't die and recovers, they'll be fine. And that persisted until 1942, when Randolph Byers, who was a director of neurology at the Boston Children's, I had the good fortune to know him when I went to Boston, was referred to children who had attacked their teacher. And he recognized them as children he had treated for lead poisoning and discharged as cured. So Randy Byers had a real quest for knowledge. He was a very perceptive man. So he went to the records of the Boston Children's Hospital and found 20 cases of children who had been discharged as cured and brought them into his clinic. And with a woman psychologist, they did paper and pencil tests and behavioral tests, etc. And he found that 19 out of 20 of them were slow, were antisocial, were belligerent, were failing in school. And he reported that in the American Journal of Diseases of Children in 1942, and that opened the door to the modern era of childhood lead poisoning. Things changed after that.
Well, here you were in the mid-1950s, mm-hmm. and you became really interested in this. You knew that this was a socioeconomic problem that,
yes.
that had to be solved. It wasn't made illegal to put in interior house paints until the 70s.
Right.
What happened in between? I thought you'd just write this up and everybody'd stop.
I thought so too, but it didn't work that way. And it still hasn't worked that way. There still is plenty of lead in the children's environment, despite the fact that we know a great deal about it. Part of that is due to the lead paint companies who promoted lead paint. They Sherwin-Williams promoted it to children. They had coloring books, and the picture of Dutch Boy was their emblem, you know. And there are pictures in which the Dutch Boy is painting and children are in the environment watching, and there's a little puppy dog spilling a can of lead paint. All this was just invented to make it appear harmless fun, whereas they knew at that point that the product was poisonous. And that's continued. The lead industry has fought very bitterly to disguise the toxicity of their products.
So what happened for you? What did you do next when you realized it was a problem?
Well, I decided I would pursue it. And I looked for a way of looking back in a child's history of lead exposure. The biologic half-life of lead in the blood is 7 days. In other words, if you take enough lead to have 20 micrograms per liter in your bloodstream, in 10 days it'll be 10 micrograms, and then it'll be 5. It doesn't stay in the blood long, but it does go to bone, where it stays for a very long time. So the tissue you want to look at is bone, but you can't do that. You can't stick needles in kids' bones. But it occurred to me that the deciduous tooth was a bone, a free biopsy of bone, painless biopsy, that every kid gives up. So I collected...
Baby teeth.
I was the tooth fairy. It is a cartoon of me as the tooth fairy. And I showed that it is indeed a good tissue for measuring a child's long-term lead exposure. And that got me a trip to Harvard and an appointment there to study it. And that I began my first major study in 1978, something like that. And we collected thousands of teeth, over 2,000 teeth from children in Somerville and Chelsea. We measured the tooth lead levels. We brought in children in the highest and the lowest 10th percentiles and did an extensive battery of neuropsychologic tests. And we found that children who were in the high lead level had significantly lower IQ scores, more behavioral disorders, more language problems, more attentional problems. When we published that in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1979, it had a considerable impact. That was at the time when Williams Ruckelshaus, who was the head of EPA, was considering, he was under pressure to take lead out of gasoline. And there was a lot of pressure to keep lead in gasoline. And I think that kind of pushed him in that direction. Lead was taken out of gasoline. And blood lead levels around the world began to fall after that. It was a pretty important effect.
Well, journalists know when they poke a giant, they can expect some backlash. And you were poking some pretty big giants saying, we can't have this lead in pain.
Yeah. By the mid-late 70s, early 80s, there was a large body of information, not just from me, but from neuroscientists around the world, stating that lesser amounts of lead were dangerous, that, and in the absence of symptoms, they were dangerous. And it was a very formidable thing. There might have been 30 or 40 papers from different investigators. And I think the industry felt that they couldn't attack everybody. And so they decided that they would try to discredit me because I was kind of at the center at that time. And they did. The way they did it was they had, there was a big lawsuit filed by the Department of Justice against the owners of a lead mill in Utah because they had mined this lead and they'd thrown the tailings out on the ground and then houses were built on it and people were in jeopardy. And the EPA asked the DOJ to conduct a suit so that they could get money to repair that, the ground. And the senior attorney from the DOJ asked me if I would appear as a medical witness about the toxicity of lead, and I said, sure. And then I was visited by two psychologists representing the defense, two women psychologists who wanted to look at my data, which I did. I had very persuasive and very large amount of data printouts. And they came and they left, and then a couple months later I was notified by a lawyer in Philadelphia that I was being accused of scientific misconduct. They presented an argument to the federal government, and that began a nasty period in my life.
Well, what were they basing scientific misconduct on?
They looked at the data and they said that I had chosen my subjects with knowledge of what the effect was rather than doing it blindly, and I had manipulated it to get this outcome, which was ridiculous because on the front page of every data run was a set of instructions to the computer as to how to handle the data, and it said select if A, et cetera, et cetera. There was no history of lead, of brain damage. There was no convulsions, et cetera. So that was all done by computation. No human hands touched that. And that was conclusive proof that there was no selection of cases. But they persisted. They had, the lawyer for them was from the firm of Hunton and Williams, which was the law firm for Ethyl Corporation of America. And when they were asked who was supporting them, they would not answer. They were on the payroll of the lead industry. It was a nasty period in our lives, but we got over it.
So how did you fight that?
By showing the truth, by showing the data, by having other lead experts, my colleagues from around the country, come and testify about my work. They did a very persuasive presentation that it wasn't only my work, there were others, but I was kind of the one who first broke the ice on this issue.
You're listening to Tech Nation Health. I'm Moira Gunn in our 2008 interview with Dr. Herb Needleman, a pediatrician, child psychiatrist, researcher, and professor at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, about his work with children in lower socioeconomic settings and the impact of lead poisoning. You were saying earlier that it wasn't just like IQ points, but we're talking about real behavioral impact. And while you saw some of the sickest people, obviously, in your practice, and that would be the practice here around Pittsburgh, we had paint all over the United States.
Yes.
We had children growing up in this all over the United States,
right,
and for many years. Have we been able to determine a society-wide impact?
There are a number of epidemiologic studies which show that, well, it's a changing picture. Since we took lead out of gasoline, things have gotten better. Not altogether better, but better. But there are still large numbers of children, particularly inner-city children, who have elevated levels of lead. Now, at the same time, better science has shown that the effects occur at lower and lower doses. So you have two different vectors there. You have the fact that the exposures are decreasing, but the science is showing effects even at lower levels. When I started, the conventional wisdom was that 60 micrograms per deciliter was a toxic dose. So if a kid had a blood lead of 61, you'd treat him. If he had a blood lead of 59, you watched. It was very easy to make a decision. Now, because of the new science, better models, better techniques, we now see effects at 10 or below. There are a number of papers in the past year or two which show deficits in IQ primarily at less than 10 micrograms per deciliter. So you have two opposite things going on. The exposure is decreasing, but their knowledge of the sensitivity is increasing.
Could there people be listening to this show who are definitely affected?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Would they know it?
No. They might feel that they're more irritable than they should be, or, you know, but there are many other causes of these things, so it's hard to make a clear instruction about that.
You mentioned the two boys who attack their teacher.
That's right.
How contributive could this be to what we generally call juvenile delinquency?
Well, I've studied that. Randy Byers was the first to report that these two children attacked their teacher were children who had been lead poisoned. And I've heard, and I used to treat lead poisoning when it was more common, mothers would often tell me that their child changed after recovery, that a child who had been pleasant, calm, listened to their mother, now won't sit still, won't pay attention, can be violent if frustrated. I've heard that a number of times from mothers of lead poisoned kids. So that's been in my mind a long time. And after we reported the IQ issue, in the IQ issue, there were some questionnaires which suggested that behavioral disturbances were in effect. We studied that in Pittsburgh children. We looked at children 7 and 9 years old, two groups of kids in Pittsburgh. We used the behavioral rating scale of Achenbach and Edelbrock, two well-known psychologists, which asked a number of questions. And we found that children who had high lead in their bones, that by this time we were not relying on teeth, we were doing an X-ray fluorescence analysis of bone. The children with high lead in their bones were more distractible, more aggressive, more delinquent. And we published that in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1992, I believe. And then the next logical question was, well, does it make a difference in arrest rates? So,
in arrest rates?
Arrest rates.
Oh, arrest rates.
Yeah. So we had the cooperation of the president of the juvenile court, Joe Dogerdas, who gave us access to two groups of boys in Pittsburgh. There was one group who went to it's an old factory that had been converted to an educational institution for delinquent kids. Then there was an outpatient enterprise which did the same thing. So we got a number of boys who had been arrested and adjudicated as delinquent by the court, and we compared them to a group of youths of the same age who attended the same high school as these boys did. And we found that if you had high lead in your bone, we measured their bone leads again, you were four times as likely to be adjudicated delinquent as if you had low lead in your bone. So we made an estimate that somewhere between 11 and 38% of the delinquency in Pittsburgh youths was attributable to lead exposure. And other people have subsequently found the same thing.
And do we know if this continues throughout your life?
Well, these boys were 16 or 17. We're going to be following up a group of subjects that I picked up at birth who are now 28, 29. We'll be able to make some kind of assertion about that.
So the science is not yet in.
Right.
Jerry is not yet in. It says here that you won the right to have an open hearing with legal representation against the scientific fraud. You mean you weren't...
You want me to tell you about that?
Yeah.
Okay. What happened was when the report was filed with the National Institute of Health, they notified the dean of the medical school, and the next thing I know, my files were locked. I was not allowed access to my own data files except in the presence of a university officer. So if I wanted to work on defending myself, I had to call her up. She would come in and sit there, and I would do my stuff. We had these hearings, which the university wanted to have closed. This would be done only with only me, my lawyer, the university, and whoever they chose to attend. And I said, oh, no, this is too big an issue to be handled in private. I want the hearings to be opened, and anybody who's interested can come, that faculty, students, journalists can come and evaluate this. We had a big fight about that. My attackers at that point, who said they would be happy to come, said once they opened it up, said they weren't going to come. But they were persuaded by the university to come and say that they could refuse to answer any question they didn't want to answer. So we had open hearings, and I think the case was very convincing that these people didn't know what they were talking about, or that they were cynical. That's more like it. And then finally, after a long period of time, the announcement was that there was no scientific misconduct.
It's kind of jarring hearing that they came and locked your files and you couldn't...
Oh, it was terrible. It was absolutely degrading, you know.
You're listening to Tech Nation and our 2008 interview with Dr. Herb Needleman about his work on the impact of lead poisoning and the challenges of being a scientist whose research proves it. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation, Biotech Nation, and Tech Nation Health are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, I'll speak with Dr. Perry Neeson, the CEO of Sanford Burnham Prebys Medical Discovery Institute, and Dr. Oliver Fetzer, CEO of Synthetic Genomics. Stay with us. You are listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Dr. Herb Needleman, best known for his scientific research on the impact of lead poisoning and the experience of being a scientist whose research faces economic pushback.
So we had open hearings, and I think the case was very convincing that these people didn't know what they were talking about, or that they were cynical. That's more like it. And then finally, after a long period of time, the announcement was that there was no scientific misconduct.
It's kind of jarring hearing that they came and locked your files and you couldn't...
Oh, it was terrible. It was absolutely degrading, you know. I was a professor, and they treat you as if you're dishonest. It's really ugly. Ethyl Corporation, the International Lead Zinc Research Organization. I asked those questions of them. I said, who's paying your legal fees for this guy who was an attorney for Ethyl? They said, we don't know.
We don't know?
Yeah. I mean, it was bizarre.
Is there a name on the check? Just asking.
Yeah, right. It was bizarre. I think it relates to some of the things that are going on now where the industries are still fighting to weaken environmental laws. We know so much. We don't know everything, but we know a lot about what we can do to prevent illness. And we know that corporate structures and financial considerations deeply affect our judgment. One of the places where this is most visibly evil is in the purchasing of opinions from academicians. If you look at people who are making enormous amounts of money as consultants for the different pesticide industries, for instance, you understand why progress is so slow in getting good regulation for poisons. I mean, I was on the EPA's science advisory board for pesticides. I was a pediatrician on the board, and it was quite clear that the EPA was bending over backwards to give a lot of elbow room to the industry, to the pesticide industry.
There are many who work in areas that, as we like to say, bite into the food chain of others. And when you do that, it's not pleasant. We're finding more and more of our technologies are affecting us.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
Like Terry Collins, you know, with the endocrine disruptors in the water supply, because all the pharmaceuticals, I mean, all of a sudden we're realizing some of what we've done ends up having really, sometimes it's for children, sometimes with adults,
right.
But frequently they're biting into somebody's food chain that doesn't want it bitten into. And
right.
For either, number one, they don't want to stop making money, or number two, they don't want to be put on, you can imagine their lawyers advising them, put on the hook to have to pay to remediate any
right.
of this. It's like, oh, no, or just go away. And one of the things they do is they get attacked.
Yeah.
And so I want to say, what do you want to say to young scientists or any age scientist or person working in an area that finds that technology in modern life, you know, it's like you're ringing the bell here and it can have ill effect.
My advice would be, first of all, do good science. Don't get carried away. Be very careful in your studies and make sure that they're defendable, that they're not subject to attack, or they're subject to attack but not vulnerable. And then if you're serious, you got to take it where the data takes you. If you believe in your work, you have to express yourself.
Dr. Needleman's breakthrough scientific work comparing lead levels in the discarded baby teeth of urban and suburban children was published in the journal Nature in 1972. What came after was an instance of science coming into opposition with highly profitable corporate activities. To quote Dr. Bernard Goldstein, the former dean of the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health, Herb science, to use a term already used by others, was an inconvenient truth. It was groundbreaking work of the highest importance. He was a hero to all of us in the public health community. I was able to interview Dr. Needleman in 2008. He passed away on July 20th, 2017. You're listening to a special edition of Tech Nation Health. Dr. Perry Neeson is the CEO of Sanford Burnham Prebys Medical Discovery Institute, headquartered in La Jolla, California. Widely recognized for his career in drug discovery prior to joining SPP, I wondered how Dr. Neeson got into drug discovery in the first place.
I trained both in basic science and in clinical medicine. So I, as you just said, have a PhD degree in molecular biology, having started out in the very early days of recombinant DNA and genetic engineering with a father of that in the 70s. And then also have a medical degree and trained as a pediatric hematologist, oncologist. And there was a real pivotal moment in my professional career. So I was an academic physician scientist, had a basic research laboratory, and made a bit of a discovery that really kind of had a splash. It was a well-received publication, picked up by an article in the New York Times. I got a grant. And in the academic world, that was a really
big deal. You're the top of the heap.
That was it. And then had this experience of that afternoon, then putting on my white coat and going to see a patient. This is a family I took care of for many years. It was a girl with a brain tumor. And had to have this discussion with a family that I've had in the past several times about where medicines had failed this young girl and there was really nothing else to offer her. And there was this moment of, I guess I'll call it cognitive dissonance, of here there was this discovery and it got all this attention and recognition that in my heart of hearts knew would not have impact to get to a medicine for patients. I had cured all these mice, by the way, but was never going to have an impact on patients. It was at that moment that I really did take the decision to change careers and move to the pharmaceutical industry. And then I've had a 20-year journey and privileged experience in the pharmaceutical industry at the interface of very basic science, bringing that into making medicines, bringing that through clinical development and medicines to the market, which is an amazing privilege to just have that experience of over years just seeing discoveries of others helping shepherd that and bring that to medicines that really have an impact for patients.
For many patients.
Many patients, exactly. So that was one turning point. And then after all of those years in the pharmaceutical industry, recognized the opportunities, the limitations, both in academic science and in basic science in academia and in pharma. So there are, you know, in academia and in basic science, just deep understanding insights, so critical and so creative, so important, sometimes unencumbered by timelines and deliverables and sometimes reproducibility. And in pharma, the ability to do things at scale and resource to do that and technology to do that and understanding of what it takes, you know, to make a medicine that people could use with safety, et cetera. The challenge of attention deficit disorder a little bit in pharma of, well, leadership changes and now we don't want to work in this area where people worked for years trying to understand something. So that engendered yet another decision is there a way to bring together the best of both worlds, the best of really academic science and real creativity and insight with some of the best of pharma in terms of scale and rigor and timelines and project management and all that stuff that could be anesthetizing to academics but could really lead to something and fill that gap in between to get new medicines on the road because pharma in general is also kind of risk averse until they really know that something is going to potentially turn into a medicine and create value for patients. It's hard to invest in that. So that's kind of been my journey through kind of at the interface of basic science, clinical medicine, academia, and the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, they certainly all come together now. You're the CEO of Sanford Burnham Prebys Medical Discovery Institute, which is not just – was not your mother's institute. It's not any other institute that I know of in how it brings all those things together. And let's talk about that. What's the institute about?
So it's an institute that has first and foremost independent – investigators, faculty who are really a remarkable cohort of individuals. It's an institute that started over 40 years ago, first as a cancer research institute that has expanded over the years with individuals with expertise, not just in cancer, but also immunology, aging, and neurodegeneration and other degenerative diseases and metabolism. And in addition to those basic investigators, and there is also an accredited graduate school, so we award PhD degrees to graduate students and have postdoctoral fellows. There's also been an investment over the years in what I would describe as professional drug discovery. So there are 70 or 80 folks, most of whom came from the pharmaceutical industry, who have spent their careers making medicines. And it's this opportunity and challenge of bringing those worlds together to really translate some exciting and interesting discoveries for those who are really interested in making that happen, with the wherewithal and the know-how and capability to get those ideas moved into something that could create value for patients. And through both the ability to generate grants from the government. So the investigators are remarkable in that regard and really
NIH generous. Likes you.
NIH has been extremely generous, but it is, you know, it is an incredible challenge to secure funding to get grants. You know, now maybe, you know, fewer than 10% of meritorious applications get funded. And I have to say with incredible pride that our investigators compared to all of their peers, are amongst the most successful, which is reflective of the quality of their science. That, together with some generous philanthropy, has really helped a lot. But all of that is unpredictable. So one of the challenges that I have is, as a chief executive, is to secure a long-term sustainable future for that science that could be applied. And how do we achieve that? Well, for me, that's serving my passion, which is to create value for patients that's going to matter, and then feed that back into more basic science that could turn into things of relevance and importance to patients, and bring the best of both worlds and avoid the worst of both worlds toward that enterprise. So minimal bureaucracy. We avoid all imaginable, or I try to avoid all imaginable hairballs that get in the way to liberate investigators to do what they want to do, not to expect that they have to apply and translate, but those who have the appetite to do so, that we help that. And in an environment that's very low-key, extremely collaborative, and we have two sites, one in La Jolla in San Diego and another in Florida. And, you know, the one in La Jolla that I'll mention in particular, an amazing environment of there's UC San Diego, there's Salk, there's Scripps, there's us, and we're all contiguous. And people come to each other's seminars, people collaborate all the time in this just sort of low-key, collaborative environment. It's the first institute that I've ever gone to where there was a request for, well, where can I keep my surfboard because I go surfing at lunch, which I'm still trying to come to terms with, I have to say. It's not my life experience growing up in an apartment in New York City.
I can imagine. I can imagine. I have to say that most scientists that I know that work inside a pharmaceutical company and are trying to move the research through, paramount is, will there be a return on investment? How do you make a decision as to which, I guess, I don't know if I would say treatments or which lines to pursue?
It's a really important question. And I'll tell you my perspective after so many years at it. And I don't have the secret sauce to make those decisions. But what I've learned over the years, then I think there are three essential components that lead to that success. You have to have a deep biological, mechanistic understanding of what you're going after. You can't just do. One. Two, you have to have the know-how and capability in an applied way to make something that you could give to somebody and know what it takes. And thirdly, you have to have understanding of what's the unmet need. So what do patients want and need? And if you could bring those pieces together, that is a predictor of success.
You know, it is interesting. So many times I do hear, more on the academic side, people saying, well, I'm going to study this. It'll move this a little bit here and a little bit here. They're actually on the fringes of the science. They're doing good things. But that doesn't move the whole area forward, you know.
So that's, I think, an important and interesting piece. I think there is a challenge of what are the most important questions that need to be answered. That's easy to say, but really hard to answer. And how does one converge on that? Does it take critical mass of people? Does it take people with different perspectives to kind of converge on trying to come to a solution? I think that's one part of it. And then there's scientific serendipity. I mean, people pursue a particular area. And then there are these findings that are outside of the bell curve that, whoo, and new insight, and then have the courage and resolve to do that. I think those are two important pieces. And then in terms of fundamental basic research, I mean, there is this element of rigor and really doing something carefully and knowing that it's right and reproducible is another important issue and challenge, and that others can do it. And then some of the incentives in terms of being the first to publish, or, you know, the, you know, sexiest first paper or the grant to do it, could, you know, not sometimes complementary with the former of, is this really indeed real, reproducible? So those are some of the challenges.
There's a lot going on where you are.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
It's so exciting. Exactly.
That's true. Well, Dr. Nason, I could talk to you for about 2 weeks straight. And neither you nor I have that kind of time. But I want to thank you for coming on. I hope you'll come back and see us again.
My pleasure.
Dr. Perry Nason is the CEO of Sanford Burnham Prebys Medical Discovery Institute in La Jolla, California. More information is available at sbpdiscovery.org. Sometimes in science, you're only as good as your tools, while at other times, your tools take you to new places. With the earliest DNA tools, we were only able to splice out little snips of DNA and insert them in other places. Now, with the latest technologies, we are able to type text strings of the four nucleotides which make up DNA. In short, G, C, A, and T. And the actual physical DNA can be produced. I asked Dr. Oliver Fetzer, CEO of Synthetic Genomics, how did we get from those early steps to where we can type letters on a computer and end up with actual DNA?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. Maybe a step back 15 years ago, we didn't even know how to read DNA. It all started.
And now we are one. Oh, wait a minute. We always were.
With sequencing DNA, that was the first part, saying in 15 years, the cost of sequencing a human genome has gone from $100 million to $1,000. So now we're at the point where people can read. That's a starting point. So the next thing is what you talked about. It's writing, right? How do you write DNA and why would you want to do it? So how you do it, in our company, we've come up with a little box. It's a machine that literally would fit comfortably on a writing desk. And you can upload the DNA sequence of interest.
Upload like a text file?
Literally like a text file through a web portal. It gets sent to our company. We then design an algorithm that we beam back to the machine. As a scientist, you load the reagents onto the machine, press a start button, you go home, and the next morning you have your custom-made DNA that you specify through the web portal ready to use.
It's in a tube?
It's in a tube, yep. Actually, multiple tubes. You can do multiple different runs overnight, so you can have different DNA constructs ready for your work.
How big is this box?
The box is about 3 feet by 3 feet.
Not very big.
Not big at all. No.
Bigger than a bread box, but not by much.
Not much
the
bigger.
Old, is it bigger than a bread box? That's just sort of, it's almost magical. Is it? Is, you have to have it very cold? Do you have? Is it room temperature?
Yeah, so there's in it, there's something called a thermocycler. A lot of the reactions that you need to use to put the pieces of DNA together run at different temperatures. So you go from cold to hot to cold to warm. And so that's part of the algorithm. It actually programs in the different temperature conditions. There's liquid handling in it, so different reagents get moved around automatically that have the different building blocks. And then you stitch them together piece by piece, and at the end of the night, in the morning, you have your DNA constructs ready.
Is that a production quantity? Are we really talking about labs, research?
The use of it is you normally stick it then into what's called an expression cell, where a cell then makes more of it. So you can put it into a cell and you can grow the cells. And if you want to make a lot of it, the easiest way is you start with the custom-made DNA, you stick it in a production cell, the cells replicate, and then you go back and harvest that if you want to just make the DNA. In many cases, you actually want to use the DNA to program the cell to do something. So in some cases, you don't need large quantities at all. You just introduce it in the cell in a particular way that you then effectively reprogram the cell to do what you want it to do, which has pretty far-reaching applications when you think about human medicine, for example.
My mind actually isn't fitting in this studio very well right now. It's like, wow. Okay, let's talk about some of the applications. What do you do with that?
Well, we think ultimately everybody talks about precision medicine or personalized medicine, but they haven't really been good answers to do that cost-effectively. So think of a cancer patient where you have a tumor sequence from a biopsy. So you now know what the particular tumors that this patient has. Wouldn't it be nice to make a medicine that is just specific for that patient? And how would you do that? Well, the way you would do it, for example, is you would want to express the proteins that are unique to the tumor but not unique to the healthy cells so that the immune system can see the proteins that are unique to the tumor. And then your own immune system starts homing in on the tumor and wipes it out. Which, by the way, most people don't appreciate, that cancer only happens when your immune system has snoozed through an aberrant cell and doesn't see it. Right?
Yeah.
So we know the immune system is normally really good at detecting a cancer cell and wiping it out before it becomes a disease. But when you have cancer, somehow the immune system didn't recognize it. So the idea of making very specifically the proteins that are unique to the tumor cell to then boost the immune system is really important. So how do you make those proteins? Ultimately, DNA codes for proteins. So if you can make the DNA that is specifically designed to code for the proteins that are unique to the tumor, you can now inject that DNA. You have to package it and put it in a vector. I won't bore you with the details of that, but you can then inject it into a patient, and the patient will then...
The immune system says, hey, this is not supposed to be here.
Exactly.
Gets rid of everything you injected,
exactly.
Plus gets rid of any cell that that protein's attached to.
It gets effectively trained and learns that this isn't supposed to be here and then will attack the tumor. So we just recently announced a partnership with a company that has a proprietary system to use this information to make neoantigens. And they came to us saying, hey, you guys have a box that can make DNA on demand. Wouldn't it be nice to put one and one together and do this together? So that's what we're doing. So we're effectively now enabling the first clinical trials using this approach of automated DNA manufacturing.
The size of this box and the ability, once you figure out what it is I want to program, it's almost like you could have DNA, you could have this DNA box in every lab.
That's the goal, yes. It is also not particularly expensive. You can buy a base model for $50,000, so it's not something that will blow the budget of a research institution or a company. And as people are moving into the second chapter of genomics, of wanting to build their own DNA, we think people would want to have this box because currently you have to order your DNA from a service lab. So if you currently want DNA, you put your order in with a service lab and you wait often several weeks before your DNA comes in. So we think one of the key things that we enable is very quick turnaround time. So scientists can literally make the DNA for the next experiment on demand. So one of the things that I get pretty excited about is to take the machine and take it a step further. So we recently announced a publication in Nature Biotech on what's called the DBC, the Digital Biological Converter. So you can now use Again, the same web portal, or you can just send an email with the file saying, not only do I want to make DNA, I want to make RNA, which is what messages
DNA,
from RNA
protein.
To protein, or I want to make protein. And so the DBC, we are showing with that machine that we can actually do all of it on one machine. Now, that's a little bit bigger still. We have to miniaturize it. So at this point, imagine a small minivan. That's the size of a DBC. But it can receive the instructions of making either DNA, RNA, or a cell-free protein. So now you've created literally a pharmaceutical manufacturing operation in a box, or you've created a discovery operation in a box, because if you're a discovery scientist, you can just simply say, hey, I'm interested in these different proteins as potential drug candidates, and I can literally print them out overnight for you. So that's already, as a prototype, functioning. We'll spend the next few years to get it to the point where the BioXP is today, which is a commercial model you can buy.
You know, we always say in engineering that the creators of a technology can never anticipate all its uses. They have a couple of, you know, applications in mind, and then every time this technology gets in the hands of somebody new, it's like, wow, I could do this. We never anticipated this. Very seldom do I run into a technology where I go, we haven't even begun to figure out what we're going to do with this. You have so many potential applications. You must be thinking of new ones every day.
Yes, but ultimately I want our customers and partners to think about them, because I completely agree with
you. You're very
busy. we can't come up with all the things, but we can certainly create some of the tools. And if you think of DNA as an operating system, instead of using zeros and ones in a computer, you're using, as you pointed out, ACTG, the four letters that make up the DNA. You can imagine that people were on a program, different cells for purpose, and you can solve a lot of sustainability problems with that. Many of our most innovative drugs are already made by cells, so you can use an E. coli cell or a Chinese hamster ovary cell or some cells that we are working on that are custom designed to make protein therapeutics, and you can start programming them. So we believe it'll dramatically change the way drugs are discovered, are made. They become more cost-effective. They become purer. So it can revolutionize so many different things. It would be preposterous for me to claim that I know all of them. But what I'm seeing today is already pretty mind-blowing.
I don't think anyone anticipated that we could get this process into a box this quickly.
Yeah.
And it's stable and it's there. I mean, yeah. That is an amazing, amazing concept. So congratulations. I hope you'll come back and update us on all the great things that are happening.
Happy to do so. Thank you, Maura.
Dr. Oliver Fitzer is the CEO of Synthetic Genomics. More information is available at syntheticgenomics.com. For TechNation and this special edition of TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BioTechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BioTechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.